Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. On October 6th, the World Health Organization had approved the world's first malaria vaccine. It's been hailed as a historic breakthrough and by some estimates could even save tens of thousands of lives each year, mostly that of children. Now, but researchers have been trying to develop a vaccine for malaria for more than 100 years now. The question is, why has it taken so long? And will this be the end, the beginning of the end for malaria, which is, you know, among the oldest known and most deadliest of infectious diseases? Our guest today is Dr. Sarta Das, the Chief Executive Officer at Asia Pacific Leaders Malaria Alliance, which is a coalition of government representatives from 22 countries in the Asia Pacific committed to eliminating malaria by 2030. Dr. Sartak, welcome to the show. Now, I think we'll start with the most kind of the most news-driven item of the day, which is the vaccine and this the WHO approving the malaria vaccine. Could you maybe walk us through why this is considered a historic breakthrough and what the vaccine actually does in terms of fighting malaria?
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back. So this is an mRNA vaccine, which has been in development for over three decades in terms of vaccine development for malaria, but specifically for malaria in high transmission settings, which means high burden settings. In this case, the study which yielded breakthrough results, I certainly do not want to, as we go along in our discussion, diminish the importance of what has just happened, given the complexities of and all of the incredible work that's gone on across the world among scientists. So this is a vaccine that is designed to provide protection against P. falciparum, which is a predominant parasite in sub-Saharan Africa. The study that was conducted took place in three countries, Ghana, Malawi, and Kenya. And it showed to have a 40% reduction in malaria episodes and a significant reduction in severe malaria of approximately 30%. So just the fact that a vaccine has been in the works for three decades and we have something now that works, again, with modest efficacy, but in terms of the complexity of designing the vaccine, is a huge leap forward for a first generation, something to build on moving forward. And, you know,
if I could jump in there, and I think perhaps for the general public, you know, the comparisons will be immediately to COVID and the coronavirus and COVID-19, the disease, and the efficacy rates of vaccines for this phenomena. So I wonder if you could help us understand from a kind of a medical, pharmaceutical, you know, scientific point of view, why we're not seeing that these the coronavirus vaccine levels of efficacy in the malaria vaccine.
Yeah. So, you know, to keep it as basic as possible, we're talking about a completely different series of events that are happening in terms of both the life cycle of the mosquito, meaning vector, the life cycle of the parasite, the interaction between those two and populations set against the backdrop of climates, seasonality, and obviously environmental factors. So, you know, if you take even one piece of those, how does malaria get transmitted? It's being transmitted through mosquito, right? That's passing along this parasite, and how those mosquitoes behave in different contexts among different populations varies widely. And at the same time, when you think about where there is more malaria happening, that's where this study was done, where there's more higher areas of transmission. That's where we see where this study saw the most significant results. But it's not as straightforward as looking at something. I mean, not that COVID is in any way straightforward, but we don't have this added issue of the vector of a different vector of another creature,
right.
Basically, mm-hmm. Right? So that complexity in and of itself affects what we're seeing.
All right. So I was reading an article that talked about why the parasite that causes malaria is far more insidious and sophisticated than the virus that causes COVID. I think the line was comparing the two would be like comparing a person and a cabbage. And I thought that really kind of stuck with me, because then it gave me a sense that this is two completely different things we're talking about. But can I just come back very quickly to the development of the vaccine? I think it's quite interesting because you said it's been decades now that this vaccine has been in development. And I'm just wondering, because we saw the speed at which we got the COVID vaccine developed and approved, I'm wondering about why it took so long for this vaccine to be developed, for the trials to undergo trials, because if I'm not mistaken, I read somewhere that it was reported, the trials were first reported in 2015. Then it took a while for the pilot immunization program to get underway, and then the approval by WHO, which is a really long time frame to be battling a disease that is so deadly the way malaria is. Can we talk a little bit about why you think it took that long?
To be the most blunt about it, it's because it's a disease of poor people. When we look at the world and we look at what the burden of disease is in terms of, let's say, up until recently, the three leading infectious diseases that attracted most of the world's attention in terms of global health, HIV, TB, and malaria, all of those disproportionately affect poor communities, and there's incredible evidence across the world of those disparities. And so when you have something like COVID, which is not the same in any by any stretch of the imagination, we those of us who work in malaria advocacy or have worked in advocacy with other infectious diseases have routinely affected that. And one very important point to note there is that HIV was actually something that benefited enormously in the early days from the attention that it garnered across, again, a segment of the population who were in, OECD countries that weren't in really the low income or lower middle income in the early days. And so I think that's just the bottom line, that is the sad truth. I don't think that there's another explanation other than that. It's taken a long time to get the kinds of resources in a coordinated manner to put the energy behind it and in the human capital and the material capital.
I think you, when we last spoke a year ago, we touched on this whole question of inequality in healthcare and in development of pharmaceutical interventions. And the warp speed of COVID does show that where there's a will, you can often find the way because the money comes along with it. I do want to ask you if we could just look at some of the dimensions of the vaccine before we get to the question of access and distribution, which is also going to be a problem, I guess, which is its effect on children. If you could help us, why is it that children seem to be disproportionately victims of malaria?
Children, first of all, are more, when we talk about vulnerability to malaria and especially severe malaria, we're talking about, when we say children, I think it's good to begin to unpack that. And so we're talking about under five, and even within under five, under 24 months of age. So we're talking about smaller children. And as we know, smaller children have emerging, developing immune systems. There also is the added, I mean, again, it's like all things with malaria, it's complex to answer, but, you know, we have the added complexity of where are we talking about, because the behavior of the mosquitoes in those places, the conditions in which people are living, I mean, we do find certainly pockets of endemic malaria among rural, remote migrant workers, for example. But I think that that's really the essence of it when it comes to thinking about the vulnerability of children in particular. And then the other question that you asked in relation to that was?
Well, you know, so the intervention, how does this vaccine help? Are we looking at, are these oral vaccines, or will it be a jab that's administered?
No, it's a jab, and, you know, it's also, again, I think one of the really important things for us here, both in Asia Pacific, especially in Asia Pacific, is to come back to this. So yes, it's a jab. It's not just one. As far as I'm aware, based on what was done, we're talking about four doses of this. And so that's another thing to consider, because the areas where this is being targeted, again, let's remember, it's where the health systems are, where there is high transmission happening, where the health systems are probably are much weaker. And so that's just one of a host of issues that we'll need to be thinking about. But I think that, you know, there's incredible excitement, you know, certainly in sub-Saharan Africa. But one of the things that's really incumbent on us to do is to make sure, in particular, as we look to work with governments and to advise other stakeholders, is that we need to be very measured here. First of all, in Asia Pacific, we don't know, right, where this will fit within within the arsenal that we have, because there haven't been trials done in this part of the world. So let's just that, right? The second thing is that one very important thing for us to remember with malaria, and this includes this vaccine, there's no magic bullet. So if we look at the standard things that we do, case management, rigorous surveillance, continuing to do rigorous surveillance, anti-malarials and vector control measures like bed nets, that has proven quite effective in eliminating malaria from 40 countries in the world, and in this region, China and Sri Lanka. So this is going to be another tool in the arsenal, but it's not going to supplant the other tools, nor should it be understood as, you know, somehow going to be just something that comes in and means we can forget about everything else.
Brilliant points that you made there, and we're going to continue this conversation and kind of pull at those points in just a couple of minutes. We'll take a quick break now, but let's continue our conversation with Dr. Sarthak Das in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned to Consider This. Hi, welcome back to Consider This with Sharad and I. Let's continue this conversation with Dr. Sarthak Das, CEO of the Asia Pacific Leaders Malaria Alliance, which is a coalition of government representatives committed to eliminating malaria by 2030. Dr. Sarthak, if I may come back to something you said just before the break about the significance of this development to countries in Asia Pacific. And as you mentioned, you said that the the immunization programs were kind of pilot immunization programs were run at in the sub-Saharan African countries. And I'm just wondering what this development might mean for countries in Asia Pacific. Are the challenges in Africa different from the challenges in the Asian Pacific countries when it comes to malaria?
Yes, so vastly different for the most part. Let's think about the fact that almost 90% of the malaria cases we have are concentrated in five countries: India, Indonesia, Pakistan, Papua New Guinea, and Afghanistan. And so if we look at that, just first of all, the remaining malaria that we have is really in these distinct pockets of, let's say, Cambodia or Vietnam. But at the same so that's one piece, which is very different from sub-Saharan Africa. And then the other piece is that even in those countries that I've mentioned as being countries with the highest burden of malaria, we're still not talking about malaria across an entire country. If we talk about Indonesia, we're thinking about, for example, high endemicity in a place like Papua in eastern Indonesia. Or in India, we're talking about states like Odisha or Madhya Pradesh, and particularly among remote tribal communities. So it's a subnational phenomenon, if you will, and that makes it quite different in terms of the epidemiology across Asia Pacific and its diversity. So just begin with that. And then we have to think about the fact that any country that's going to get involved in this adoption will necessarily look to some level of validation in their own context. And because, again, this was something that was developed not only in sub-Saharan Africa, but in very high transmission settings, there probably are a limited subset here. Now, this is not trying to, by any means, diminish what's been accomplished. It's just really important to, again, stress the fact that this is a first-generation vaccine that now would need to be built upon, and that's going to take some time to adapt for this context.
Sartaka, you know, you mentioned in the first part of the show, you know, that there is an arsenal in the public health toolkit, and that the vaccine, as you see it, will play a part in that and will not supplant the other parts. And I'm thinking about some other news. I mean, you know, this is the problem with journalists. We all go to Googling furiously for malaria and breakthroughs, and there's apparently an eco-friendly toxic cocktail that can be given that is directed at the mosquito, not at the human person, in terms of trying to solve the malaria issue. Could you speak to that, the question of the mosquito, as opposed to the human being?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure about the specific cocktail that you're mentioning. I know
it's the HMBPP. Okay. Supplemented beet.
I know that there, you know, that as you may be looking at, gene drive and ways to alter mosquitoes. And I think that stream of work is certainly proceeding with the blessing of the World Health Organization. And I guess what I would say is that I think that those are, again, really important areas of research and inquiry. I think that's number one. Number two, I think that all scientists or good scientists come into that with a fair bit of humility about what it means to begin to alter any ecosystem and what the sequelae of doing that might be. And number three, when it comes to malaria, again, this is not to say that we shouldn't vigorously pursue innovation, but the advantage that we have in malaria is that we have countries in the world and even in our region who've managed to eliminate malaria with some tried and true methods that rely on being thorough, diligent in foci investigation, the training of people to do manage data, do surveillance, do entomology, and be able to systematically get to the last pockets and eliminate this without a ton of high-tech tools. And I'm not being a Luddite and saying we don't need those tools, but I do think, having been in global health for a while, that what we can do is end up spending disproportionate energy, attention, and resources on the shiny new objects versus just plodding along methodically at the things that aren't as interesting, which means investing in human capacity to be able to manage a public health program.
The last time we spoke, Dr. Sarthak, you told us a really interesting story about how, if I'm not mistaken, was it in Sri Lanka, where malaria was, you know, drastically reduced, malaria cases were drastically reduced just through kind of analog note-taking, pen and paper, methodically going and following up with those cases. And I think that's a really fascinating story. Can you elaborate a little bit about, you know, what kind of resources you'd like to see more focused on, apart from just, you know, we have this fascination with the silver bullet vaccines now, particularly in a time of COVID-19. Where would you like to see more attention, resources focused in terms of the fight against malaria?
Right. So I think there's a good news story in what's happening right now in the world, because we are recognizing every day we're not safe till everybody's safe. So if we start from that fundamental premise, one, and we recognize, two, that the places where the systems are the weakest may be the most vulnerable to an emerging pathogen or a mutation in an existing one, that is telling us loud and clear, it's where we need to make sure that we use this opportunity to strengthen the system in those places. And so what do I mean by that? If you want uptake to happen of any new technology, you still are gonna ultimately, or a new diagnostic tool, a new way of thinking about managing data, there is no substitute for the hardware in that place. That means the hardware of basic infrastructure. Whether we think about investments in cold chain, investments in basic things like electricity, which are fundamental to, as we're seeing now, being able to get different types of variations of the COVID vaccine out. But basic infrastructure needs to be there. But I think we need to also start adopting this knowledge or sense that infrastructure also means human infrastructure. And that means that we really need training and capacity building programs in bread and butter public health management that operates in a cycle of, let's say, 3, 4, 5 years to really build that capacity in the places where the systems are the weakest, so that there is a clear ability to use data in a way that works for that context. So the data is the same. You know, we know these are the kinds of data that we need to do foci investigation or to track where the outbreaks are. But the way that we do that, sometimes becomes, let's plug this new software in and let's put it in that laptop in that place. But we don't ask the people in that particular health center or in that particular district, how would you like to best use this interface? What would work for you? And so I think it's public health management capacity centered around things like surveillance, data, supply chain. There's no way around getting those operational controls right to be able to do good public health. And there's that. So it's investments in that kind of capacity building over the longer term, where the places are that the systems are the weakest, combined with the requisite ensuring that the infrastructure is in place. You know, I know it's not a very interesting answer.
No,
No, it is on the contrary.
It is interesting, yeah. We definitely agree. And thank you so much, Dr. Sartha, for joining us today on the show and shedding more light and context about this headline that we've been reading about. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was our conversation with Dr. Sartak Das, CEO of the Asia-Pacific Leaders Malaria Alliance. And that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching, and good night.